going fishing. Yes, I'm going fishing and my baby going fishing too.
The beginning of the 20th century brought something new to many American families: leisure time for vacations. People went to parks, beaches, fishing ponds, even mineral springs. But in segregated Virginia, African Americans had to develop their own safe places for recreation. Many of these were private businesses, and they would place ads in the African American newspapers of the day. Brian Caton is a professor of landscape architecture at Virginia Tech. He went through those old newspaper ads to learn about these vacation sites, many of which have disappeared. Brian, the turn of the 20th century was a time when Americans started traveling to natural places for leisure, maybe because there were so many more urban industrial jobs than there had been. Did African Americans also seek out natural areas and parks at that time?
They did. And surprisingly, some of them were the same sites that white Virginians had been visiting for over a century. As early as the 1890s, there were numerous black springs, mineral springs in Virginia, that African-American residents of the Commonwealth would travel to. Sweet Calabiate Springs, just across the border in West Virginia. Yellow Sulphur Springs, later in the 1920s, here in the Christiansburg area. Otterburg Lithia Springs, Colemanville Mineral Springs, both near Richmond. Silicate Springs in Loudoun County as well.
Are you saying those are areas that exclusively African Americans would go to, but not the white population?
They had, some of them, been white mineral springs for several generations. But hard times after the Civil War, they fell really into disuse by the whites. There had been always a black presence at the springs, either through servants of the people who came there, or in some cases, free blacks who worked and slaves who worked at the mineral springs themselves. So it's interesting to me that in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, those springs reemerge, in some cases purchased by black businessmen, and become recreation sites for African Americans in Virginia.
But this was during the time of segregation and Jim Crow in Virginia and other places in the South. Were even the parks and vacation areas at that time segregated?
Oh, very much so. The springs at this time were purchased by blacks because the whites were no longer using them. There were no public parks, really, for African Americans in Virginia. So the black communities had to develop their own venues. Even the sidewalks and public spaces of the city were often contentious areas. It was illegal, for instance, for blacks to smoke on the sidewalk in Richmond, Virginia.
Broadly speaking, we're talking about what time frame?
Really, probably about the 1890 period, up until the end of segregation in the 1960s. It's really the 1950s, late 1940s, when the first park in Virginia, state park for African Americans, was developed. There was work in the 1930s to develop segregated facilities along the Blue Ridge Parkway. Most of it was never built. The war interrupted the design efforts there, and after the war, the Park Service abandoned the policy of segregation at the parks. There was, in Shenandoah National Park, Lewis Mountain, which was an African-American campground, included a lodge and cabins.
But are you saying that the national parks did not permit African-Americans to come in?
They permitted them to come in, but the facilities were segregated. There were campgrounds at Lewis Mountain in Shenandoah National Park, but they were separate but equal facilities, as they were characterized in the correspondence. And they were following really the lead of separate but equal facilities in the segregated South. They were clearly uneasy about that. They would drag their feet. They were uncomfortable with developing facilities that not everyone could use. These were, in fact, understood to be national parks.
Were the places that African Americans did go for leisure outdoors during this time period refuges?
There's a tendency to think of them as refuges from the segregated world that they had to traverse on a daily basis. There's wonderful work trying to understand the real depth of the experience at these places, and they're becoming to be characterized not as places of segregation, but as places of congregation. These were places where the people could gather, they could reinforce community values, they were educational places, they were wonderful music venues as well as recreation sites. You do see in the advertisements sort of hidden references to the larger landscape and world that black Virginians had to negotiate. In 1917, there is an advertisement for Riverview Island Park in Suffolk, which at the bottom has the phrase, "You need not fear." These were really places where they could go and be themselves in a way that was very difficult in most public spaces in the Commonwealth.
What do you think they were referring to, "you need not fear"?
Well, they had to be mindful of certain actions. It was a time of, you know, really harsh segregation. They could do whatever they wanted. There was nobody going to be looking over their shoulder. They could really build a community spirit in these places. Order and decorum, strictly enforced, was included in an ad for Norfolk Bailey's amusement park. And I thought that was more of a reference to how whites would view African Americans. But in reality, there was a tremendous amount of debate within the black community about how best to bring forward their race. Many of these venues that African Americans would go to, particularly the beaches, were destinations for excursions sponsored by churches and other civic and business groups. And the faculty at Storer was concerned that that type of leisure time should really be spent in more productive endeavors to advance the race. There were many instances that talked about the hard work that African Americans were engaged in, often manual labor. And their vacations were much shorter, their opportunities much more limited to step away from that. And even a day at the local lake or the local recreation facility was considered almost a vacation in a day. And I've heard that phrase from a couple of the people that I've interviewed. Many of the excursions were weekend excursions where they would leave on Friday, come back on Sunday, or even just a Saturday when they could get away and take the train or take the steamer down the river to one of the black recreation sites.
Were these vacation spots usually public places or privately owned?
Most were privately owned. It's much later, after great efforts by the black press and black leaders to develop public beaches in the Tidewater area. But in the first four decades almost of the 20th century, these were almost exclusively private.
Were there any occasions where African Americans and white citizens vacationed together routinely?
Not that I've discovered. There were beaches that literally were next to one another that had a fence between them. So the black beach and the white beaches were kept quite separate. I've yet to run across, particularly during segregation, occasions where they actually gathered together.
What kind of advertisement was there surrounding, you know, come here, enjoy yourself?
They would list events. They would list amenities, including picnic grounds, ball fields, beaches, horseback riding. Many of these business operations were part of a network of recreation sites that black entrepreneurs developed that would include movie theaters and amusement parks in urban areas of the state, as well as lakes and natural areas on rivers and to some degree in the mountains in Virginia as well.
Were these advertisements usually in mainstream papers or in African-American papers?
I have never seen one in one of the white papers. They have always, at least the ones that I've come across, have always been in the black press, primarily in Richmond and Tidewater. Now, there are numerous papers that were published by African Americans in Virginia. Some were earlier than this landscape begins to develop. Part of the difficulty with the research thus far is finding sources. I've been very fortunate at Virginia Tech because we have copies of the Norfolk Journal and Guide and some of the Richmond papers on microfilm here. I think one of the great losses was the loss of the archive of the Roanoke Tribune. We're searching, and I know the public library in Roanoke has put out calls to find back issues of that paper. I know there's a treasure trove of information, I suspect, in the Roanoke Tribune, if we could only find copies.
You see photos in these newspapers, right?
A few, yes. The photo records are interesting. The newspapers, most of those photo archives are gone. The photos that you see are of very poor quality in the microfilm versions of the paper. But they'll show facilities. They'll show people many times, people enjoying themselves, kids at camps, bathing beauties. It's just this wonderful window into a separate but arguably not equal world. Another thing we came across that we haven't spoken about yet were what were then referred to as colored fairs. There was actually a state colored fair of Virginia, but they occurred in counties throughout the Commonwealth. People could gather with families. They were usually very temporary, only lasted a week or so. The educational opportunities at the fairs were actually quite remarkable. The premium books that were published for the fairs speak to better farming, better homes, better schools, and making of better citizens. These were conscious attempts by the African American community to self-educate themselves, to really demonstrate their skills as farmers, homemakers, and others to not just the African American community, but I think these were demonstrations to the white community as well. Some of the preeminent black intellectuals came and spoke at the fairs in Virginia.
Do you see differences, fundamental differences, in the way African American and white Virginians enjoyed their leisure time?
I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of this. I don't think there was as much difference as many people would suspect. The editor of the Richmond Planet had wonderful descriptions of beautiful mountains and the grandeur of nature. He speaks of the travels there, almost the mountains kissed the clouds, silver waters of streams, and a natural picture that enthused and intoxicated the beholder. It's a very similar experience of nature. And much of the impetus to develop parks that were available to all Virginians, black and white, that occurred in the black press, particularly the Norfolk Journal and Guide, in the period after World War II, spoke to the fact that for black Virginians, they could not experience the mountain retreats. They could not experience the beaches that whites could experience. They were limited to one park that they could go to.
Recently, architects and historians have been turning a lot of their attentions to landscapes rather than buildings. Why do you think this is? Why focus on landscape areas?
It's unexplored ground, and I think it's very important for a couple of reasons. The buildings and structures have been well identified, but the public nature of segregation and the implications that had on just the daily lives, the everyday life of the average black Virginian, were played out primarily in public space and in the landscape. It's natural for us to begin to look more at the everyday life of Virginians and how that was impacted and began to spatially alter the Commonwealth.
Has any of your research surprised you, changed your perception of people's experiences during this time?
There have been many surprises. I think one of the great surprises was the discovery of the mineral springs. They've always been associated, and almost all of the scholarship portrays them as landscapes of white privilege. And yet there was this remarkable overlay period in the early 20th century and late 19th century when they became venues for African Americans. And I think how much the African American interest in the natural features and amenities of the Commonwealth, how much that mirrored really what we expect and understand that white Virginians appreciated about our Commonwealth's resources and riches. It was very true in the black community as well.
Have you considered, as you're doing this research, that perhaps one or more of these sites may someday be a kind of living museum?
I would hope that would be the case, but unfortunately, many of these sites have long been overwritten by development or natural processes. Nature, they were abandoned and nature's taken them back over. Many of the sites that we found advertisements for, we've yet to locate the exact location. After the end of segregation, almost all of these sites vanished. Once the African-American citizens in Virginia could go to what they had been excluded from in the way of recreation sites, many of these strictly African-American venues fell on hard times. There are a couple of places along some of the rivers down in the Suffolk area that sound quite remarkable and beautiful, but it's difficult to actually locate the sites. And with many of the early sites, the people who had firsthand experience and knowledge are of a generation that we're losing very quickly. So time is a consideration here with this research as well.
Brian Caton, thank you for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
Brian Caton is the chair of the Landscape Architecture Program at Virginia Tech. Coming up next, the aging voices of Dreamland.